Welcome to the Grinders Table, the podcast where we sit with C-suite executives and founders who are taking their industry by storm to figure out how you can build an exceptional career and business. Together, we'll try to uncover how they have both defined the odds and what you can learn from their experience. Today, we have an amazing, amazing person with us. In my usual fashion, I don't like to introduce people, so I'll allow Kola to introduce himself.
Hi, Uwem. Thanks for having me. My name is Kola Aina. I'm a Nigerian global citizen, proud Yoruba man, grew up in the northern part of Nigeria, so I speak Hausa, Yoruba, as well as a little bit of Igbo, because I took a wife from the eastern part of Nigeria. Started my career in corporate finance, and then became an entrepreneur myself, built an enterprise software business that served governments and corporates. And then I started angel investing, very much an operator, entrepreneur, trying out my hands at investing in the early days. And today I work full-time as a venture capitalist, leading the Pan-African Early Stage Fund Ventures Platform. Delighted to be here.
Awesome. We'll get into your life as an investor, right? And as a key stakeholder in the African investment landscape. But I'd like to know a bit about, the time that led to you venturing into, the investment space. What exactly informed that decision?
Yeah, so when I moved back to Nigeria in 2009 and shortly after started my first technology business then called Emerging Platforms, our first product was a EdTech product. There wasn't many of us. It was myself and my co-founder, who was the full stack developer, probably one of the most brilliant engineers I've ever worked with, and I've worked with many. I had many in my career. We tried to raise venture for business, and it was impossible. We then pivoted to trying to raise debts because we had a big account, one of the largest universities in Nigeria that had signed up to use our product, but the business model was such that we would build the software, build the infrastructure for recording courses and doing everything that they needed to do to deliver distance learning, and in exchange for that, we'll have a service fee on their tuition, a percentage of tuition. But the trick was we had to fund all of this upfront, right? And so, obviously, I couldn't sort of raise for it. And so we ended up sort of bootstrapping that opportunity, started with an MVP, very much like the startups, what startups have to do today. And the rest, as I say, is history. Obviously, lots of struggle there. I think I borrowed some money from individuals, and that's how we kind of started out. And so I never forgot that experience. And so as that company became successful, I then started partly also because I've always been someone who always was uncomfortable with the challenges that I experienced. So if I had trouble with paying for something online, for instance, as we all did in the early 2000s, I was always wondering, why hasn't no one fixed this? And so, in Emerging Platforms at the time, we would set up so many project teams exploring different solutions for problems that we were confronting. But I think I also was aware that focus is important, right? And so, at some point, I decided that rather than have a company that didn't have focus and was trying to solve all of these problems, another way to go at it was to invest in people trying to solve these problems, right? People closer to the problem. Especially that also was appealing to me because it felt like a sweet revenge that I could finally give money to people to explore these ideas an opportunity I didn't have. And so that's what sort of got me into angel investing. I made my first angel investment in 2014, I believe, 2014 or 2015, a company called Makers Academy. And yeah, the rest is history. Started, you know, from angel investing, eventually that sort of grew into ventures platform in 2016, and we're here today.
Ooh, this is actually the first time of me hearing Kola as the entrepreneur. But thank you for, taking us on that journey. You talked about angel investing, and a big part of investing generally is that you lose some money. Has there been any investment you made till date where you look back and like, I shouldn't have done that?
Yeah, look, I think every investment I've made, and by the way, today now, probably more than 140 companies have been backed between my personal angel portfolio and the ventures platform fund portfolio. I don't think I have any investment. I view all of those investments as learning opportunities, right? There are a couple that I feel that I should have followed my hunch and my better judgment. And I kind of grouped those in one bucket. So very early on, Ventures Platform, we were quite vocal about the fact that we won't back jerks, people that we consider to be jerks, right? And the definition of jerks here are people who don't treat people well, people who have narcissistic tendencies, people who are mean to other people, who from a pitch call, you can tell that they talk down at their team members and colleagues. You know, I think there's probably one or two occasions where I went against my better judgment and backed people who had those tendencies on the basis that their companies had traction, right? And the way that has played out is in every case, those companies have flamed out. My hunch has proven right. That's probably the only case where I feel that I should have not, I feel a sense of regret. Obviously, that has meant that I'm now more attuned to my sort of intuition and a lot more strict with sort of investing criteria. And so I consider even those investments an opportunity to learn and get better as an investor. You never really know if you're a good investor until about 7 to 10 years in the game, right? And I think, thankfully, I'm about 10 years in the game now. So who knows? I won't answer that question anyway.
We're talking about investing in jerks and your hunch, right? Something just came to mind. We're talking about, what are the success indicators for the really successful founders? We're talking of the Elon Musk, the guys that lead the biggest companies, Zuckerberg, the Bezos, and people oftentimes say that these people are jerks. So how do you balance, going with your gut feeling, working with people that are driven, so driven that people sometimes refer to them as jerks?
Yeah, look, I think every investor has their investing philosophy. Some investors don't care so much for the package as long as the content in the package is good. In other words, some folks don't care so much about the founder's temperament. I actually, I take a very people-centered approach to my investing. I believe that even where a company I've invested in failed, the people, the learnings that people make by working in that company, the early employees, the experiences that they will have and what they go on to do is also one part of the outcome. And so I'm very much sort of interested in some of these issues that may not necessarily lead to return on investment directly. And so these things matter to me. It doesn't mean that founders who maybe are less nice, and nice is all relative, are not able to deliver outstanding outcomes. They can, and there are some notable examples that some will suggest have less than flowery personalities. But my investing philosophy suggests that you do not have to be a jerk to build a great company. And there are many examples of founders that, we've invested in that treat their people well with respect, that build great cultures. Shola of Paystack is one, Tosin of Moneypoint is another. I can go, the founders at PiggyVest are another. I can go on and on and on, many companies. that have built great companies without necessarily hurting their people in the process.
Very, very true. Now, you mentioned Shola of Paystack, and in a conversation I was having with O some time back, he sort of talked about how sometimes you have to allow companies fail for better companies to be birthed. And in your personal case and the cases of companies you've invested in, there are times that founders have to shut down their business. What is the best approach to this? I'm asking this because, you know, recently we've had founders that have returned back money. We've had founders that have, you know, pivoted and then, you know, called the investors back to invest in the new business. What exactly is the best approach to this? Because I know a number of founders are facing this dilemma at this moment.
Yeah, so I'm a huge fan of something that you call the orderly shutdown, right? I think there are different scenarios where companies shut down, right? So there's a world where you've raised a ton of money, but there's clearly no product market fit. You've tried many things. There's also a world where founders are just fatigued, right? And really don't have it in them anymore. And I think those two scenarios, for instance, are clear-cut cases or examples of where an orderly shutdown can be executed effectively, where you decide that, look, this is not going to work. We're not going to do this anymore. We can't commit to this anymore. And you do the orderly shutdown with some capital, if there's extra capital, and live to fight another day and preserve your reputation. Much more graceful than just coasting it and wasting everyone's time and capital, whatever capital is left. I feel very strongly about that. We've encouraged, we've actually been a part of one company where that was the case, and I think this is a public case now, so I can talk about the Koba. Yomi Ojo. There are cases where the shutdown just happens, right? Where you can't plan for it, where everyone is blindsided. I think where the opportunity presents itself, an orderly shutdown is always better than a flame out, which I think can be really stressful, having experienced a couple myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We all know that early stage investing involves a lot of support, right? A lot of hand holding. How do you manage that with your schedule? I'm actually pretty sure that even adds to your schedule, right? And as a busy person, how do you give as much attention to the founders that need that attention? I mean, one of the things I hear is, hey, Ventures Plus is one of those places that one of those investors I like on our cap table because they're always available to help. How do you do that? Because I know it gets tiring. You're a human being.
Yeah, look, it gets exhausting. You know, at one point, especially I had as many with some of my co-investors, I think notable co-investors that I've worked with over the years is Olumide Soyinbo. And at some point, I think he shared publicly that we have over 100 WhatsApp groups with founders together. And you can imagine just managing that in itself, being available real time, managing multiple. Yesterday, for instance, I think I got two phone calls for regulatory interventions with founders. It can be overwhelming, but I think over the years at Ventures Platform, what we've tried to do is take something that we've become known for, that we truly enjoy doing, supporting our founders in different ways. And we've now built systems around it, right? We've systemized it in a way that makes it more scalable, makes it more consistent, you know, and also leverages the fact that we now have other members of the team beyond myself who can offer this support. So there's a lot of work has gone into sort of that thinking, designing it in a way that it's still personalized, as opposed to just being like a cookie cutter. And I think the thoughtfulness in that design is something that I'm really grateful for, because we've been able to preserve the sort of hands-on, customized, personalized approach with our founders. It also means that there's more division of labor, so that we can actually be, as opposed to go from doing portfolio support to more what we like to call portfolio success. I mean, I can unpack that a little more, but there's a lot of thinking that has gone into that, and that's what we now call our platform and support practice that really just looks to provide the kind of support we're known for at scale, but in a personalized manner.
And people don't typically appreciate the amount of work that goes into portfolio support or portfolio management. But with portfolio support, you also have to decide which companies should I actually direct my most attention to, right? For Ventures Platform, how do you handle that dilemma?
Well, look, I think the honest truth is there's a power law in venture capital, right? And as much as we love and appreciate all our portfolio companies, I want to support them all. Over time, as your portfolio starts to materialize, your top 20% start to become obvious. And you wouldn't be doing yourself and your other stakeholders, investors, or what have you, any good if you're not sort of allocating most of your time to those companies. Because at the end of the day, we have to remember that our job here is to return capital, right? Obviously support companies, but support companies towards the objective of returning capital. And so I know it sounds counterintuitive that, you know, the best performing companies get most of the time, because one could argue that the companies that struggle more probably need more of the time. But I think over the lifetime of a fund, the way you allocate your time as a manager has to evolve, right? In the early days, you know, you try to be as equitable as possible across the portfolio. And then I think you kind of transits to supporting the companies that are the most, that need the most support. And then I think at some point you then have to transit to applying Pareto's principle, which is really in tandem with the power law of venture capital.
Absolutely. You've been investing for quite some years. There was a time I remember at Nico Stern where people were, you know, taking $5,000 checks for 40% or 50% of their business. Obviously, this has changed over time. But how have you seen the ecosystem evolve since you started Ventures Platform? And what trends do you see eventually emerging from where we are right now?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the days. I mean, when we launched Ventures Platform, standard deal was a 20K for 10%. So much better than the deal you suggested, 5K for 10%, right? And that deal was heralded as a great deal at the time. It was a fast check. It was standardized. And that obviously those days are gone. I do think that in 2020, 2021, the ecosystem got a little bit ahead of itself. And I think we're now starting to see some of that moderate, a little bit. Some of us are firm believers that our ecosystem at some point perhaps has tried to fly before it walks. And so it's great to see the current normalization that we are having. Obviously, the ZIRP era brought with it lots of hot money. But I think with the pullback of some of that hot money now, we can boldly say that there is definitely more capital in our ecosystem than there was in 2016 and the early 2010s. I mean, for instance, when we launched Ventures Platform in 2016, all of the VC capital in Nigeria was about circa $50 million, right? If I remember correctly, that year. Today, we manage a Ventures Platform of $50 million Pan-African fund in Nigeria, right? And so I think that's testament to the growth of the ecosystem. But a lot more has to be done. We have to build a healthier ecosystem that has solid local support and participation. We've got to work a little bit more on building the environment for local companies going public on our local exchanges. We have to sort of build an ecosystem that is uniquely Nigerian and uniquely African. Because definitely copying and pasting the Silicon Valley model hasn't served us as well, and definitely doesn't suit our circumstances. And so, I mean, the growth definitely has been impressive, but there is still ways to go. And I'll be keen to see you know, what happens, particularly in terms of liquidity and exits within our local market, because that becomes important as you come of age.
Yeah, and also the case of we need more local funds playing the game, or local money. Yeah. So HNI need to start keep investing. We need more of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I did a TED talk a couple years ago where the title of that talk was "Who Own Our Future Unicorns?" And the central question I was asking, or the central point I was making, was, guys, these unicorns, and I know unicorns now is a bad word, but big companies are going to be built. The question is, would they be owned by local people? Would there be local capital in there or not? Because at the time, there was very few of us local investors actively investing. The world is, we're in a completely different place today. I can tell you for sure that, for instance, our fund, our first close for that fund was majority local capital. So there is a very respectable local element in that fund. And I think some other funds have seen some of that. Obviously, with the pullback of the market, some of that excitement has waned a little bit. So definitely we can see so much. We do need to see much more local participation, but we definitely are not where we used to be. And so I agree with you that both on the local participation and liquidity on the local markets, on local exchanges, I think there's a lot of work to be done, but we definitely have made some advancements.
Ah, I know you love arts, right? So let's talk about things that you do to de-stress. So let's say you're tired of work, or you just want to have a good time. What do you exactly do to, what do you normally do?
I spend so much time at work. But you know, two things that sort of help me refresh or recharge will be family. I've got three kids, a teen all the way to, a young son. And just spending time with them, whether we travel or we're just home watching a show. We love watching documentaries together because my kids are quite curious. And then the other thing I do is really the arts. Definitely been quite fortunate to sort of collect and be a patron of the arts. I consider many artists as friends. If I wasn't doing VC, maybe I'll be an artist. I often kid. I actually painted when I was younger, in university, actually, just for fun. So I really love sort of visiting galleries, exhibitions, going to fairs. We sometimes plan our family travel around that. And I serve on, you know, a couple of boards for museums and whatnot. And so the arts will be the other bit of it.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Arts, music, films. Oh, yeah. I remember you were one of the, was it executive producers in a blockbuster movie that was on Netflix?
Yeah, a couple actually. So now probably just got a good update actually on my fifth film investment. Toyed actually with the idea of a film. Was quite fortunate to back Black Book, also backed Gangs of Lagos as an exec producer. And we have an upcoming Nollywood / Bollywood blockbuster coming on stream. And so yeah, that's also been and that's sort of you know, feeds my investing and art muscle really well. Film as something to do. When I get a chance, I love to visit the sets. I don't always get a chance to, but you know, it's really exciting to support this form of art that really is very exportable, right? And it's becoming one of our greatest exports. So yeah, kudos to all of the producers and directors that allow us to be a part of their vision.
Mm, great stuff. I was speaking with Damilare. I founded a company called Food Llama some months ago, and he was talking about how raising a child is almost as difficult as building a startup. Now you have kids. How do you manage, you know, being present in their lives and also being present and showing up for work, for your LPs, for the founders that you invest in?
Yeah, look, I think all of these things, activities are easier when you have a partner, right? With the fund, I mean, I started Venture Spectrum as a solo founder, so to say. I mean, I had a founding team that included the likes of Coyote who's now building a company called Telstack. Folaola, Tunde David was also part of our founding team, and they're phenomenal. I consider them, day one founder level guys and part of a family. My current partner, Dotson, joined. That definitely has helped tremendously, right? And even on the family front, it does help when you my wife plays an incredible role. I definitely couldn't have done all of what I do without that support. And so I think the secret source here, partnership, partners that are supportive, that understand, that are aligned. And I think I started to have more peace with my schedule the moment I gave up on the illusion of work-life balance. I don't think anything like work-life balance exists or is attainable. The way I sort of operate is I literally plan my year in December, and then I review it, from time to time. I spent 30 minutes this morning with my assistant just going through my schedule because we update it, right? Obviously, I plan trips that include vacations and off time and work, but things pop up. And then we respond. And so just being deliberate with time, holiday, off periods is critical as well. In terms of work-life balance, for me, I truly believe that there are periods that there will be high intensity, and there are periods where you can have slightly less intensity. And you just, you have to sort of build the muscle and build habits that take you through both phases on a daily basis. So for instance, I practice meditation. My faith is a big daily sort of part of my life. Exercising is also important. And I think those disciplines kind of help me stay sane, whether I'm in a high intensity period or in a low intensity period.
Very true. I remember a conversation I was listening to and Jeff Bezos saying, similar things, saying that work-life balance is an illusion, but instead it goes for work-life integration. And like you said, figuring out how to be deliberate with your time and prioritizing for time just to ensure that, both sides don't suffer extensively. Earlier in our conversation, we talked about biases. And a big part of investing is you go with your gut feeling, right? How do you identify your biases, or how do you how are you able to identify your blind spots and ensure that as you're investing, as Ventures Platform is investing, you're investing in a manner that doesn't ensure that unconscious bias influences your decisions?
That's a very, very unconscious or conscious bias.
Both.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'll tell you one that I think very early on, I was very strong on or very big on founders that had palpable ambition, that you could just, see the ambition and drive. And I remember one particular deal where we were engaging with a founder who was slightly more subdued, slightly more realistic, had a more progressive approach to sort of traction. And I remember having doubts about this founder a team member challenged me to say, look, if you really take a step back and even look at some of the more ambitious founders, when rubber meets the road, then things don't always go the way folks plan, right? So, or don't always go the way things are modeled out on the business model or in the deck. And so would you rather someone who's super hype and super excited, or someone who has a more pragmatic, realistic approach that's slightly more progressive. And then I remember really reflecting on that a little bit more and coming to a realization that I had a very unconscious, I had a bias towards founders that weren't as aggressive. And you know, I really started to check that. And so I think the one way we solve for that is that we're a very democratic organization. And so there is room for multiple view. We welcome contrarian perspectives. We, after every pitch call, most founders don't know this, but after what we call a team pitch, we actually sit back on the call and then we have a debate. And all views are welcome. And that's one good way that we get to not individual team members don't, but individual team members' biases are kind of checked. But the foundation of that is that we've also hired deliberately to solve for that. So there's very little group think. We consciously try to sort of avoid that. You know, and there's a host of other things in our investing process that are designed to solve for that. But I think the starting point is really how we select people that get on our team, but also how we ensure that all the voices are heard. And maybe thirdly, I'll add just personal leadership, like in the example that I gave, where I recognized one of my own biases and really started to try and walk towards ensuring that it didn't influence how I viewed various opportunities.
Oh, thank you, Kola, for all your time and your insights. As we round up in the next 1-2 minutes, I'd like to ask one last question that I ask everybody. Now, how will you rank and give us reasons why? Money, power, pleasure, and fame. Which is most important to you and which is least important to you?
Money, power,
pleasure, fame.
Fame is least important to me because fame is fleeting. It's fleeting. And I think it kind of encourages the behaviors that I find unattractive. And also sort of doesn't necessarily lead to, you know, there are many examples of across the world of where fame has sort of misled great people. Definitely something that needs to be managed. Top of my list would be money. I find money to be a very powerful tool that you can utilize to effect so much change in the world, not necessarily for personal aggrandizement or personal pleasure, but what you're able to achieve with capital, right? You know, think about all of the millions of kids in Nigeria that you can put back in school, the influence you can have on political outcomes, you know, the influence you can have on cure to various diseases like cancer, right? I find money to be a powerful tool and that's kind of why I do venture.
Awesome. You missed out pleasure.
You said to pick the top and the least, right?
True. That's what I said.
Pleasure is fleeting, right? It's great to sort of have pleasure, but I definitely won't rank pleasure as top or at least somewhere in the middle. Pleasure here and there doesn't hurt. Just what you definitely don't want to live a life of pleasure all the time.
Yeah. Thank you, Kola, once again. And it was really great chatting with you. Have a great day.
Thank you very much. Take care.
That's all on today's episode of The Grinders Table. And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at MonsieurUM. That's at Monsieur for Mr. in French, UM. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.